Hello, Patreon. We're back with another episode of Behind the Files. I am joined again by Erin.
Hello.
And Jess.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you both?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Yeah, very well.
On today's episode, we will be talking about Case 174, Vicky Arnold and Julianne Lay; Case 175, Gail and Rick Brink; Case 176, Ying Ying Jung; and Case 177, 657 Boulevard. So, Case 174, Vicky Arnold and Julianne Lay, to recap, was one cold winter night in 1991, best friends Vicky Arnold and Julianne Lay vanished from their town of Atherton, Queensland. The two women had left for a late-night fishing trip but never came home. 2 weeks later, their bodies were found in Julianne's car on a remote bushland track, in the opposite direction from where they'd been headed to. Julianne had been beaten, cut, and shot. Vicky died of a gunshot wound to the head and was found with her hand on the murder weapon, a sawn-off 22 Ruger rifle. Within an hour of arriving on the scene, police determined the case was a straightforward murder-suicide, and Vicky was the culprit. But the strangeness of the scene left many unanswered questions. Some went as far as saying it had been staged, and that there was another person investigators should be looking at more closely, Julianne's husband, Alan Lay. So, Erin, you researched and wrote this one. Take us through the process.
So, late last year, I received an email from a listener asking that we cover this case. She is from the Tablelands region where the crime took place, and she noted in her email that it should have received a lot more attention than it did. She included a link to a summary of the case, and as soon as I started reading it, I knew that I wanted to feature this case as a case file episode. And the other thing that struck me is it really does seem like a crime that should have been more well known. None of the Australians in the case file team had ever heard of it. It's quite infamous amongst locals in the Atherton region and perhaps Queenslanders who were paying a lot of attention to the news in the early 90s, remember it, but it doesn't seem to have made much of an impact on the rest of the country.
Yeah, just touching back on the fact that no one in the case file team had heard of it, that's pretty unusual for an Australian case, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, usually the case file team is pretty all over Australian cases, but I had never heard of it, and I actually visit the Tablelands quite often. I've got family that live up there, and so I'm all over, you know, that part of the world, and I'd never heard of it. And neither had my family that actually live up there and had lived very close to where the crimes had occurred. So, yeah, it's interesting. It didn't seem to get much coverage.
Has there been, was there anything that you came across, Erin, to suggest why that might be the case? It's always difficult to determine. There's so many factors that come into play with coverage of a case. But anything in your gut?
No, not really. It definitely received quite a bit of attention from some journalists, one journalist in particular who we talk about in the episode. If you go on YouTube, there's a variety of news clips about updates in the case. Each time there was an inquest, there'd be news about it. So I really don't know why it hasn't really become more of a part of the Australian consciousness.
So where did the research start with this case?
Well, pretty much as soon as I started looking into it, I realised that there was one journalist who was really the authority, and that's Robert Reed, who's written 3 books about it. And he has been really instrumental in keeping the case in the public eye and pushing for it to be reopened each time, you know, an unsatisfactory inquest was held. So I knew I should speak to him, and I sent him an email. He called me back and was just really great to speak to, very helpful and really encouraging. He just really wants people to know this story and supports any attention possible on the case. He's also built really strong relationships with both women's families over the years. He initially offered to introduce me to a relative of Vicky's, but she didn't really feel she was in a place where she could revisit the case at the moment. She was very supportive of us doing the episode, but she wasn't up to doing interviews about it. So then Robert suggested I speak to Vanessa Stewart, Julianne's sister. He keeps in touch with her, and he'd recently found out she was writing a book about the case and about her own experiences. And it turned out to be really great timing. I got a call from Vanessa after Robert gave her my details, and we ended up chatting quite a lot over the course of a few weeks. She told me that if we'd reached out to her sooner, then she wouldn't have been in a place where she could talk about it. But she's recently been revisiting her memories and her experiences really just over the last couple of years since Alan Lay died, and for the first time has felt she is in a place where she can talk about it.
It's a case that's come really close to your heart now, hey, Erin, with all your interactions with the family.
Yeah, it has. It's something that previous team members have said before when they've developed close relationships, working relationships with family members. And I guess this is the first time that's really happened for me on a case that I've researched and written, and it really does impact you. I think all cases are tragic, all cases break our hearts a little bit, but when you get to know someone who is a victim of a crime, you feel very protective of them and of the episode in general.
Yeah, and it just brings back that these people are real people who have been involved in these crimes. We're not just telling stories. You know, these are things that have happened that have impacted people greatly, and it's something to always keep in mind.
Yep, absolutely. Well said, Jess and Erin. Is there anything in particular that Vanessa wanted to get across in the episode?
Well as sharing some really lovely memories of her sister and of Vicky, Vanessa's key message that she really wanted to get across is how predators work, how grooming works, and how misunderstood those things still are to a certain extent today. I think at the time when news broke that Vanessa and Alan were in, quote, a relationship, as it was described in the media, she was really portrayed as, you know, a very promiscuous teenage girl who had seduced her sister's husband, which could not be further from the truth. And that has led to Vanessa feeling a lot of shame and frustration over the years. Everyone who met Alan Lay said he was very charming. Vanessa said that Julianne used to joke he could sell sand to the Arabs. And police officers who interviewed him also made note of how good he was at winning people over, at reading situations, telling people what they wanted to hear. So I think she really wanted to share that message of how predatory these people can be, how they play on people, and that victim blaming really has to stop when it comes to victims of grooming and sexual abuse.
Yeah, it's a very important message. It's kind of hard to comprehend that that's how Vanessa was portrayed in the media. I mean, you only need to look at that photo. I think we put that photo on our Instagram, didn't we? I mean, she's a kid.
Yeah, and that photo was very important to her. She held it up in a courtroom and used it as an example of how young she was. And I guess the early 90s were a very different time, but still it seems ridiculous that you could ever blame a minor for something like that and portray it as a relationship between equals rather than one that is clearly predicated on abuse.
And what a strong and brave woman to come forward as well and be open to sharing that.
Yeah, a big thank you to Vanessa from the entire Case File team for her willingness to be open and honest with us about some incredibly painful chapters in her life. We're very touched that she was willing to trust us with telling her story and her family's story.
Well said, Erin. A couple of questions for this one. The first one is from Stefan. Do you think it was Alan Lay or the criminal gangster that killed Vicky and Julianne?
That's a really tough question. I know that Robert Reed is completely convinced it was Chris Dunley, the gangster who was hired to carry out the murders, whereas Vanessa doesn't really see how that would work. She believes that Alan did it. One of her points is that the couple who supposedly saw the two women with Chris Dunley, their story did change a little bit over time. And she also notes that Chris Dunley was a very terrifying character. He was quite notorious. And Vicky was a very shy person who would have been quite timid in the presence of somebody like Dunley. And yet there was no indication that either woman was uncomfortable being in his company. It's really hard to say. I've gone back and forth over it myself. I could see either being a possibility, but I suppose I lean more towards Alan Lay.
And I think there's little doubt that if it was Dunley, that Alan was behind it.
Yeah, he was the puppet master who orchestrated it all.
Robert leans that way because he did some testings with the timings, didn't he?
He did. I think he timed how the amount of time it would have taken Alan to get to the crime scene, to carry out the crime, and then get back home and have a shower, clean up before meeting with Vanessa in the middle of the night. He says it just wouldn't have been physically possible for him to do it in the limited space available. But Vanessa has wondered whether it was actually later in the night than Alan told her it was. The power went out, so all the clocks were not working, and she just had to rely on what Alan told her the time was, and she has wondered over the years whether perhaps he lied to her in order to make his alibi work. Vanessa is 100% certain that she was used by Alan as an alibi.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Especially, did the power just happen to go out that night, did it? Or was everyone else's power out? Or
yeah, it was like a wire that got tripped in the house, and so he said he had to reset it shortly after the women left to go fishing.
What are the chances of that?
Exactly. And we've also got a witness, the adolescent who saw Julianne's car with her in it, Vicky in it, and an unknown male silhouette in the back seat a few hours earlier than the women supposedly left to go fishing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think what Vanessa says there does make a lot of sense. It would have been very easy just to come up with a time that suited him with no way of Vanessa being able to check that. Also, just the story of the three of them casually wandering into a shop the next morning.
Yeah, and Vanessa has also made the point she doesn't really think the descriptions match the women physically. I think they describe one of the women as having sort of gingery hair, and Vanessa has said neither of them had ginger hair and just their body types didn't quite match.
The next question for Case 174 is from Andy. As the case file team saw all the research for Vicky and Julianne's case, do you think it was reasonable of the police to assume a murder-suicide theory? Even so, why do you think the police were so persistent even after contradictory evidence began to be found? Erin?
No, I don't think it was reasonable. You've got two officers who were there from the beginning pretty much who said the whole scene looked very staged to them. They had their suspicions about it from the get-go. The placement of Vicky's hand on the rifle just didn't add up, and the positioning of the bodies was very bizarre. I think if you ask different people, you'll get different answers on why they were so persistent. Robert Reed's perspective is that they were very, in his words, just lazy country coppers who wanted to wrap up the case quickly, didn't have experience with this sort of a crime, and were also concerned about budget and not going over budget. Vanessa has said she has wondered if there has been a little bit more of a cover-up. Alan Leigh may have had contacts within the police. It may have been a little bit more underhanded than just a case of investigators not being experienced.
Yeah, I could see both scenarios. And based on the conversations I've had with everyone, Andy, I don't think anyone in the case file team thinks it was reasonable of the police to assume a murder-suicide theory. I guess from all the cases we've covered and people we've spoken to and things we've seen over the years, don't underestimate laziness and incompetence and just general apathy. I'm not saying that's what happened here. I've got no idea. As I said, I could see both scenarios playing out, but you'd be surprised how often apathy and incompetence plays a hand. It's not always a conspiracy. But yeah, I think we can all agree it was horrendous police work. And good on the junior coppers who were there for still looking at it behind, you know, on the quiet, despite being told not to by the senior officers. So at least that was something. As for why the police were so persistent, even after contradictory evidence began to be found, again, I've seen this time and time again over the last few years, it's just humans. Once you come to a conclusion or you know, pride. You don't want to be wrong. You don't want to be proven wrong.
They often speak of investigators having tunnel vision as well, don't they? As being one of the worst things you can have as a detective investigating a case, where you latch onto something and try and find all the evidence to support that one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Conclusion.
That's huge. Yeah, you say it time and time again. Don't want to admit that they were wrong or might have gone down the wrong road initially. I think being open-minded and being willing to admit you're wrong is so crucial for an investigator.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
And one more question for Case 174 from Saraneth. I've always appreciated the special angle used to begin telling a case file episode. In the case of Vicky and Julianne, it was her friendship that led to the purchase of the gun. How and at what point in the writing process do you decide where an episode should begin or what interesting side story leads into the main content? I've always really loved that aspect of how Case File starts off.
That's a really great question. I think it can really vary from case to case. Sometimes you'll be researching and you'll read something and think, this is where I want to start the episode. This would make for an excellent introduction. And other times you can go back and forth, or it will change during the editing process, even after the script is finished. With this particular case, I actually had a different intro to begin with. I started with the two women having lunch that day and one of Julianne's children wanting to listen in on a private conversation they were having, and Julianne sort of snapping at the child and telling her to go back to her room. But then I think I was about halfway through the script and I suddenly thought I should start with the purchase of the rifle instead, because as well as making quite an ominous beginning, that rifle really plays such an integral role to the entire case. It's the reason, or it's one of the reasons, that the police were convinced Vicky had to be responsible. It's also one of the reasons she couldn't have been, because she really didn't have any experience with firearms. And for those who knew her, it was just so inexplicable that she would buy this weapon. So that gun, that rifle, really became such a key part of the story. It sort of hit me all of a sudden that that would be a really interesting way to start the episode. It would sort of be a red herring that would take on greater significance as the rest of the story played out.
Thank you, Aaron, and thank you for the questions, Stefan, Andy, and Saraneth. Case 175 now, Gail and Rick Brink. The recap of this one is, when newlyweds Gail and Rick Brink failed to show up to their respective jobs on the morning of November 23, 1987, the alarm was immediately raised. Family members soon discovered the couple's bodies at the ranch house the couple had only just purchased. Both had been shot multiple times in the head, execution style. Their relatives, the Brinks and the Weingartens, were distraught. Gail and Rick were both well-liked, with no known enemies. The slaying shocked the quiet community of Holland, Michigan, and everyone had a theory as to what might have happened. Aaron, you researched and wrote this one as well. How did this one come about?
Yeah, this was a case I found when I went down a bit of a YouTube rabbit hole. I was looking for my next case and I saw a news clip about a man who was arrested for the 25-year-old murders of his sister and her husband, and how he'd committed the crime to conceal incest. And it just sounded quite different from anything we'd done before, and I thought it would make for an interesting episode.
And this case was one with less resources than others?
Yeah, there wasn't as much out there as there usually is for the stories that we cover. I did find a documentary, an episode of a series called A Wedding and a Murder, which is, I think, on the Oxygen Network, which had interviews with Gail's sister and also the cold case team who solved the case. But even though it was a shorter case and there weren't as many resources out there, it was still enough to make it work for a full episode, and it ended up being longer than I initially thought it would be. In terms of structure, I very much approached it from beginning with the crime and how senseless it seemed to everybody back then, before slowly bringing to light the revelations that emerged decades later. There are a number of family members who'd heard strange things from Ryan, but they just didn't put it together at the time and attributed his bizarre comments to shock.
One question for this case from Saraneth. Two of the episodes you worked on in this group had situations of incest, a subject that has always grossed me out. Was that hard to write about? Do you find some topics harder to write about than others? What do you do to get a mental break from a really disturbing case?
Yeah, some topics are more difficult to write about than others, and you definitely need a break in between cases or in between even just writing or researching sessions. What I do to get a break, I really love nature, so I always go on a walk every day and try to get somewhere. Even though I live in a city, there's a lot of beautiful parks nearby and I'm near the beach, so getting out into natural settings is really crucial. And I also love yoga as a way to just really slow down my overthinking and take a bit of a break from some of these really disturbing topics.
Yeah, I'm the same, Erin. I find not so much the writing of the case, but the researching can really take its toll on you, especially if it's for a difficult case with a sensitive topic. I like going outside as well. Also like getting lost in a good book that has nothing to do with crime to take the edge off sometimes.
Yeah, I have to say, if you look through my Netflix history, it's a lot of trashy shows that come up. I'm not really into watching anything heavy outside of my work.
Yes, same. I've gone from a lot of true crime documentaries to good old trashy TV.
Yeah.
Or interior design shows.
That's common. I'll do the same. Yeah. Happy Gilmore or Napoleon Dynamite or something ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's a way to get a break.
My secret shame is that I am obsessed with the show Virgin River, which is on Netflix, which is a very corny, romantic drama sort of series set in Northern California. So it's just beautiful scenery and just a lovely environment. And I think over the past year, I've watched the first season a total of 8 times because it's Jeez. Just so soothing. Wow. And that's what I go back to again.
Yeah. That's your go-to. Do you like talk along with the characters? You memorized all the lines?
I can in some scenes for sure.
Wow.
But yeah, you do need a break. It can get really heavy sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Case 176 now, Ying Ying Zheng. On June 9, 2017, Ying Ying Zheng vanished on her way to an appointment in Urbana, Illinois. The Chinese visiting scholar missed her bus, and after she failed to return to work that day, her colleagues quickly raised the alarm. CCTV footage would soon reveal that a driver in a black satin Astra had picked Ying Ying up. Investigators quickly realised that they weren't dealing with a missing person case. This was a kidnapping. Their digging soon led them to a prime suspect, a self-professed serial killer named Brent Christensen. Erin, again, you researched and wrote this one. Take us through it.
Yeah, this is one Millie assigned to me quite a long time ago. I think I wrote it. It could be as much as a year ago. I'm not quite sure. I've sort of lost all sense of time since the pandemic, but it's been in the pipeline for a little while and it was eventually assigned to this book. I think what stood out to me about this case, particularly compared with one of the others we've discussed in this Behind the Files, is how good some of the police work was. Obviously, we cover a lot of cases that have pretty botched investigations, so it was quite refreshing to see how diligent some of the officers were in this particular investigation and how quickly they were able to hone in on the suspect.
Anything you've learned about Ying Ying or anyone else that didn't make it into the episode?
Yeah, Ying Ying was just a remarkable human being. The more I read about her, the more blown away I was with how just incredible she sounded. She was the first person in her family to attend university, and she was obviously a brilliant academic, very bright. But her entire motivation in having these goals of becoming a professor was so that she could provide for her parents. All the money she earned, she spent buying them gifts, and she was really the shining light of their home. We do cover that obviously in the episode, but one thing that I thought was quite interesting is that as well as being academically gifted, Ying Ying was a musician and a great singer. Back in China, she played guitar and sang for a band called Cute Horse, which I think is such a cool band name, and it just sounds like she was a delight to her friends and family alike.
Yeah, well said, Erin. She certainly did There's no questions for this one, so we'll move on to case 177, 657 Boulevard. The recap of this one is 657 Boulevard in the affluent neighbourhood of Westfield, New Jersey, immediately caught the attention of Derek and Maria Broadus. The striking six-bedroom, four-bathroom, Dutch colonial-style home was the perfect place to raise their family, or so they thought. As the couple started renovations on the homestead in 2014, their actions drew the ire of a mysterious objector known only as the Watcher. Jess, you researched and wrote this one. Take us through it. A little bit of a different episode for Case File.
It was, yeah, and the first of our Patreon picks as well, which is very exciting. I remember you told me about this case and sent me a link about the Watcher, and as I read through it, I was just absolutely horrified. And, yeah, I really wanted to cover it. There's not a lot of information out there, just a few articles, a few quick news stories. So that's why it was ideal for a Patreon picks episode. It was always going to be a bit of a shorter case, but one that was so fascinating that I'm really glad we got to cover it instead of having to skip it because there wasn't enough out there.
Yeah, for sure. I think it was by accident too. I was researching something else on YouTube. It was a YouTube rabbit hole. I think something on this came up in the recommended videos and I couldn't help myself.
Yeah, and it's one that's really captured the public's imagination. There's not a whole lot out there officially on it, but if you ever go into forums, they're crowded with people and their opinions on the Watcher case and investigations and suspects, and, you know, people are really fascinated by it.
Yeah, it's almost like something in a movie, really, like a horror movie. But I did see that Netflix optioned it, so...
You know, it's one of those cases that I think our listeners either loved or hated. You know, it wasn't a traditional case file episode in that no sort of physical crime occurred, but I think the psychological aspect of it was, you know, just as terrifying.
You touched on forums a minute ago and you said you spent a bit of time on forums for this episode. Any interesting viewpoints or theories on there?
Yeah, I fell down a bit of a rabbit hole reading up about what people thought about the case and their suspicions and the investigation, and found it really interesting. And one thing that stood out to me that wasn't sort of mentioned in any of the articles or news episodes covering the topic was that the man who was seen sitting outside the Broadus house in his car, who was initially considered maybe a person of interest, the police spoke to his girlfriend and she said that he was known to play dark video games. In one game, he called himself the Watcher, which at the time aroused police suspicions that he might be involved. But somebody on a forum suggested, and I just thought that it was, you know, maybe a possible scenario that this person had been in fact playing the game The Witcher, two very similar sounding names, and perhaps he was just an innocent person playing a video game called The Witcher and got dragged into this as a person of interest for it.
We've got two questions for this episode. The first is from Byron. In regards to the Boulevard, you stated the first letter received by the new homeowners was written with a thick black pen, but the letter was typed. Was any analysis conducted to determine if the handwriting on the envelope matched any of the suspects?
Hey, Byron. I went back through my research and had a look, and no, I couldn't find any evidence that the handwriting was compared, although I do know that they kept the envelopes for DNA analysis, so presumably you would think that would be something that they might look into, but I couldn't find any official documentation that was done. I know they hired a private investigator who looked at the typed letters and analysed sort of the content of those to get sort of a picture of who might have written it. But as for the physical handwriting, I couldn't find anything. From other research work I've done, I know that they need quite a large sample of handwriting to be able to match it to somebody. So I don't know if maybe on the envelope, just the block letters with a name and address was enough to be able to match it to anybody anyway.
And the second question is from Demi. For 657 Boulevard, what was the logic for excluding the friends of the Broadus family? It's such an interesting story because Derek Broadus was so freaked out when the letter came in. But then when the friends of Broadus family letters came out, it made everyone wonder if it was a hoax.
So I'll just fill those listeners in who don't know about the friends of the Broadus family. This came up when Derek Broadus allegedly wrote letters to some of his neighbours after they had accused him of being the Watcher online. And he was quite upset about that. So he wrote to some of his neighbours and titled these letters Friends of the Broadus Family, you know, saying that he had nothing to do with these letters that were arriving to his doorstep. We chose not to put it in because being a Patreon Picks episode, we wanted to keep it short and sharp, and we'd already covered the fact that people suspected that Derek may have been sending letters to himself in there, so that's why that didn't make the cut.
So, any theories about this case?
Well, I always found it really interesting. I thought that perhaps the Watcher was somebody who knew the Broadus family and used this opportunity of them moving into a new house as a way to perhaps scare them. But, you know, that made no sense given that somebody before the Broadus family, they received a letter just before they moved out, and other people in the street had received letters from the Watcher as well. You know, makes it seem like it was to do with the house itself and not the Broadus family.
Yeah, I agree, Jess. It's hard to know. I had a similar thought as you that perhaps it was targeted towards that particular family, because why did it stop after they moved out or relinquished ownership of the property? But perhaps the person responsible for writing the letters just got a bit spooked and thought they better stop while they were ahead.
Yeah. I'd love to know more about it. Love to know who it was. The police, I think they're pretty sure that, you know, they've got a radius from their house where they think the Watcher lives. And they do think it's somebody pretty close by. But I guess until we uncover it, we'll never know.
And we've had one question come in while we were recording, not specific to any episode, but it's from Thelma. I might be a bit late, but this one is for Erin. As you have been writing such fire lately, when writing and structuring the episodes, how do you generally plot them? Your episodes always feel like there's a big twist. How do you plan and set out your writing process?
Thank you for the lovely comment, Thelma. I feel like the entire Case File team has that same sort of approach, though. We very much look at each case and try to figure out what sets it apart, what makes the crime particularly fascinating, and then we'll structure an episode in a way that is the element people will really remember. It's definitely a team effort. We'll bounce ideas off each other. We'll come up with ways to hold certain information back to begin with in order to really underscore something that's important about an episode, or the twist, if you want to call it that. On a personal note, I am definitely drawn to cases that do have a bit of a twist to them, that where there's something quite unexpected or out of left field.
Definitely, yeah. And, you know, it is definitely a team effort. Sometimes I write some things and I think, you know, this is really great, and then someone else will come up with an idea, oh, we could, you know, move this back a bit here, and it works out really well for the story. Personally, I always try to keep the twist element as far into the script as I can. So if I can write a good part of it without revealing to the audience too much, then I think that's what makes a really good script and what makes it really intriguing to listeners and want them to keep listening.
Yeah, definitely. And I think all of us have had conversations where we've really decided that that's the approach we want to take, and never underestimate a fresh set of eyes. Sometimes you can become too close to a case. You've worked on it for a few weeks, and then showing the script or running some ideas past one of your colleagues will really make you see a new way that the story could be told that just maybe takes it to that next level.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
At the same time, we always want to ensure that we remain really respectful towards the victims, their families, anyone else impacted by the crime. So we try not to structure things in a way to just for shock value's sake. But if there's a way that we can make people remember a story, remember a victim's experiences by telling the story, telling the case in a way that is memorable, then we'll do that in a way that is that honours the victim rather than exploits them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's all about keeping it memorable and not sensationalist just for the fact of being sensational.
And Thelma also asks, Casey, how many episodes into the podcast did you research and write before first bringing in outside writers? That seems like such a long time ago, Tolma, but I think it was about 20-ish. And it was just all about improving the podcast. You know, I knew I had limitations and wanted to improve it. Same with the production, the bringing Mike in to help with the audio production early. I realized very quickly I needed help there, and it was the same with the writing. So as the audience slowly grew and people were interested in the podcast, I thought I better get some outside help in here very quickly to improve the quality, and I'm glad I did. And would I ever consider researching and writing another episode, or is just recording them enough right now? Not writing, no, definitely not writing. Researching, yeah, I have researched episodes since then, on and off, and I'm currently in the middle of researching a big case right now that will be a Case File Presents podcast, a standalone podcast. A bit of an investigative deep dive into a case here in Australia. So that's what I'm mainly working on at the moment, but certainly would go back to researching Case File episodes. Wherever I'm needed, Tolma, I will go.
Recording itself is a big job in itself though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, recording is a bit of a process. It's certainly evolved since the early days. I now don't record alone. So this is the latest evolution in the recording process. I have someone monitoring the recording now, someone from the Case File team, just monitors live as I'm recording, just to pick up on mistakes and things that maybe aren't delivered quite right and things like that. It's hard to do that yourself, to monitor your own recording. And it was just starting to get out of hand. It was taking way too long. The recording time to record an episode just kept increasing and increasing. And I realized I've got to do something about this, because it's just, you get inside your own head so much. It got to the point where I was recording a line and then going back and listening, and then just convincing myself there was something wrong with it, then recording it again. Then 15 takes later, still wasn't happy with it. And realistically, if I took a step back and walked away for 10 minutes and came back, if you listen to every line, they'd all sound exactly the same. It's not like I have a huge vocal range of narration. It's pretty monotone. So, it was just getting out of hand, the recording process. So now someone monitors, and after I record a line and get inside my head about it and think, oh, I need to redo that, don't I? No, you don't. Just keep going. So that's good. That's really cut the recording time back to more manageable hours. It was starting to turn into multiple day events to record an episode. It was just, it got well out of hand. And that's it for this episode of Behind the Files. Thank you everyone for submitting your questions. Thank you for listening. And thank you, Jess and Aaron.
Thanks. See you later.
Thanks so much. Bye.